Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. The president asks Russia for help and says time is running out in the crisis in Ukraine. We'll listen to the president's words and put them to people with firsthand knowledge of the difficulties of investigating that crash site in Ukraine. We'll also have an emotional look at your neural connections to music and how that can help people experiencing severe memory loss. But first, will Russia's leader be an actual leader in the aftermath of the shooting down of Malaysian flight MH17? President Obama, speaking today at the White House, said the way forward should be simple for President Vladimir Putin in this tragedy.
Russia has extraordinary influence over these separatists. No one denies that. Russia has urged them on. Russia has trained them. We know that Russia has armed them with military equipment and weapons, including anti-aircraft weapons. Key separatist leaders are Russian citizens. So given its direct influence over the separatists, Russia, and President Putin in particular, has direct responsibility to compel them to cooperate with the investigation. That is the least that they can do.
At least 189 of the dead on MH17 were Dutch nationals, and we spoke with someone today who has had firsthand experience with the emotional frustration and trauma of watching how investigators have been held back from the crash site. Dutch diplomat Peter Feith formerly served as the European Union Special Representative and as the International Civilian Representative in Kosovo. He shared with us what his countrymen are feeling right now.
The first priority we feel we need to focus on is the return of the deceased passengers, in particular, as far as the Netherlands is concerned, the Dutch victims of the attack, and the safeguarding of the crash site. The next two steps are the investigation that you mentioned, and I should add as a third point that the longer term consequences that all of this will have for our relations with Ukraine, with the separatists, and in particular with Russia.
And this has possibly been a transformative moment for your relationship with Russia. I mean, you're on the record really being relatively skeptical of sanctions in this entire crisis. And I'm wondering if that's changing now.
Well, I think that the government is, for tactical reasons, is keeping a low profile because it wants to ensure that the bodies will return as soon as possible, and that this will be done in an as dignified manner as possible. As you've seen on the media over the last days, all sorts of persons are roaming around there and searching for valuables, I would imagine. There's also a search for equipment of the aircraft, including the black boxes. So all of this is not well organized. I'm personally, I must tell you, John, that I'm skeptical about President Putin's promises. We haven't seen his promises turn into concrete actions on the ground. So the jury is still out on that point.
Now, is that because you think Putin is complicit in this tragedy here, or that he just can't deliver it because he's really lost control of eastern Ukraine?
Well, a bit of both. And this brings us to point two, the investigation. I'm not savvy that the investigation will result in an unambiguous conclusion underwritten by all sides to the conflict on who is to blame for the attack. I think that Putin remains in denial. I think that the Russian people, to a very large extent, have already drawn the conclusion that it's the Ukraine to blame for what happened. And, you know, looking at past experience with Russia and with the separatists, I'm not very confident that we will get a conclusion on the culpability for what happened.
Meanwhile, Ukraine's leaders are calling for a bigger role for the Dutch in this investigation.
Well, I think that would be justified given the large number of Dutch victims. But then there is, of course, Malaysia and there are other nations that have a stake in this. But I think that we would like to play a role. We have technical expertise already on the spot, and we are very keen to see the investigation draw conclusions as soon as possible. But again, I'm not confident that this will happen, and it may be necessary that we will have to draw a line and draw conclusions before the investigation has been formally concluded.
Peter Feith, I have to say that your skepticism and sense that we may never know a lot of the answers to the questions that we need to have answers to makes me pretty sad here.
Well, this is the reality. And, you know, the amount of propaganda that we have heard coming out of Moscow and the way the separatists have behaved over the past months leads me to remain skeptical. Now, at some point, we will have to see what the consequences for the long term are going to be as far as Europe is concerned, the Netherlands and other countries with a stake in this. We, as the Netherlands, I believe, should be in the forefront of further action. I'm not sure if we will reach consensus with our partners in the European Union on this, but I believe that it would be alternatively useful to look at a possible coalition together with other major nations that are affected by this terrible tragedy, namely Malaysia, Australia, United Kingdom, and hopefully also the United States.
Peter Feith is a Dutch diplomat formerly serving as the European Union Special Representative and as the International Civilian Representative in Kosovo. He spoke with us from the Netherlands. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
We interrupt this world of woe and remind you that music is a way to just get away from it all and go back to another time.
This is Jerome from Florence, South Carolina, and there was a song by a group called Ready for the World. It was called Oh Sheila, that I sang to my then girlfriend. It wasn't until 10 years of being married to her that I found out that she not only hated the song, but thought that me singing it was one of the funniest things she'd ever seen or heard.
Thanks for that memory, Jerome. You know, we solicited playlists from you to help us set up a conversation later this hour about how musical memories are so powerful. There's something like time capsules in the brain. Even people with severe memory loss can be prompted back to former years, even childhood, when they hear their favorite songs.
Like a rock, I was strong as I could be.
For one of you in Winter Haven, Florida, the song is Like a Rock by Bob Seger. Reminds me of how precious time is and how fast life slips away. Tacoma, Washington, Jailhouse Rock always takes me back to the eighth grade because we dance to it daily in our classroom and during lunch recess.
This is Nikki from Kirkland, Washington, and the song for me is Helen Reddy's I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend.
I was in junior high school in Minnesota when the song came out, and it bolstered my personal fight for equal rights, being allowed to take shop rather than more home economics, and to run with the boys' cross-country team since there was no girls' team.
Yes, I'm wise, but it's wisdom for the pain.
Heroic memory there, and here's a precious personal memory from Fort Lauderdale.
Kenny Rogers, through the years, every line of that song holds a special memory to me for the friendship that I had with my closest friend over 30 plus years until she died of cancer at 42. That song is a beautiful song. Thank you.
I can't remember when you were there, when I did care for anyone but you.
This is Jim from Dundee, Oregon. The song that reminds me of my past is California Dreaming by the Mamas and the Papas.
All the leaves are brown, leaves are brown.
I would play it in my dorm room at the United States Naval Academy during the dark ages, the time between Christmas leave and spring leave, when it was cold and wet on the East Coast.
Now, how else would I have known that the time between Christmas and spring leave at the Naval Academy is called the Dark Ages? Hear that? Does it get your mind going?
This is Amy from Portland, Oregon, and what song really brings me back to a certain time in my life? I always think of Naive Melody from the Talking Heads. It has a lot of different themes, but the one that I most identified with was the concept of home. There's a line in the song that says, "Home is where I want to be, but I guess I'm already there." And I really identified with that concept of when you leave your childhood home, home is now anywhere you're at.
Coming up, how powerful musical memories are a key to unlocking people experiencing severe dementia. Keep your memories coming for us. Musical memories. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Share the soundtrack to your life. News story here in New York. It's been a weekend of mourning and questions about the actions of police in a Staten Island neighborhood. The illegal chokehold death of an unarmed man in police custody last week. Eric Garner's death was caught on video when a police stop was recorded. Garner is heard repeatedly saying, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." He reportedly went into cardiac arrest while being handcuffed, later died at the hospital. Since Garner's death, two EMTs and two paramedics have been barred from responding to 911 calls. And veteran cop Daniel Pantaleo has been stripped of his gun and badge. Residents who knew Garner spoke about their friend to WNYC reporter Kathleen Horan.
"Every time I see the man, he was saying, 'How are you doing, Herman? If you need a dollar, he'll give you a dollar.' It's not right for him to kill this man."
Activist Al Sharpton mobilized angry residents this weekend in demonstrations that Garner shouldn't have died, whatever violation he was being accused of.
"The issue is not whether one was selling cigarettes. The issue was how an unarmed man was subjected to a chokehold, and the result is he is no longer with us."
That's Al Sharpton addressing the Garner case here in New York. Joining us to discuss the chokehold and the community response to Mr. Garner's death in Staten Island is WNYC reporter Kathleen Horam. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you.
So how is the community feeling about all of this? Has Sharpton mobilized people? Is there a sense of confusion? What have you found?
There have been a number of marches since Mr. Garner's death, and people are just really shocked. They're angry. They're confused as to why police acted so violently, for lack of a better word, when Mr. Garner wasn't armed, as you heard, and he was known to be a fairly gentle, friendly guy, even though he was a large man. No one I talked to, or none of the reports that I read, showed that he had any violent tendencies.
Well, being big shouldn't be a death sentence, that's for sure, whether Al Sharpton says it or not. Does this precinct have any kind of a reputation in Staten Island, the police precinct?
I don't know their whole history. I have talked to people in the neighborhood who've said that there are aggressive cops on the street from the 120, and especially the plainclothes officers are known to sort of spring into action without warning from, you know, people I've talked to in the neighborhood.
High-profile response from Mayor de Blasio. How has that been received?
People are still saying it's too soon to decide whether, you know, he's taking the right action. He had a press conference before he went on vacation in Italy. So it's sort of a wait and see. Mr. Garner's memorial service, his funeral, is going to be held on Wednesday. And people say there will be many more marches and a lot more action after he's laid to rest.
Here's NYPD Commissioner Bill Bratton speaking.
"This would appear to have been a chokehold, but the investigation, both by the district attorney's office as well as by our internal affairs, will seek to make that final determination."
There are some reports that one of the cops involved here might have been involved in a chokehold problem in a previous incident, yes?
That's what's being reported. I haven't gotten to delve into that since it's still developing, but they have taken one of the officers officer Daniel Pantaleo. They took his gun and badge, which is a serious thing. It's, you know, many officers have been investigated for serious arrests where they've been accused of misuse of authority or brutality, and their badge and gun are not taken.
Tell me about this individual you talked to.
They patrol in the neighborhood. They try to keep it clean, and that's good. But this thing happened, they make it look bad for them.
That person seems genuinely shocked and outraged by what happened with the police and Eric Garner.
He's a combination of both. He thinks that the cops should patrol the area and respond to things like people drinking in public or fighting. But he is understandably upset that someone was hurt in this way and not for a violent crime.
Police have some explaining to do in this Staten Island neighborhood. WNYC reporter Kathleen Horan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today. That's not how many summer beach parties begin. In an echoing, nearly empty church where a few people who may not have seen each other for years show up to pay their last respects to a person who died penniless, homeless, or alone with no plans for a funeral. But for the past 12 years, the Pallbearers Ministry from an all-male Cleveland Catholic school, St. Ignatius, a student organization that leads funerals for the forgotten, has enlisted more than 400 juniors and seniors to be volunteer casket bearers at real funerals. Jim Skirl is a theology teacher and the founder of the St. Joseph of Arimathea Pallbearers Ministry at St. Ignatius. And Sean McCann is a 2014 graduate of St. Ignatius who was involved in the Pallbearers Ministry as a student. Welcome to both of you.
It's good to be here, John.
Thanks for having us.
So, Jim, what's the mission here for young people?
Well, the mission of the Pallbearer Ministry is to try to practice the works of mercy, to bring our faith to the streets of Cleveland, to be able to walk with people who have nobody else to accompany them to their final resting places.
So, Sean, when you first heard about this idea, were you enthusiastic or were you a little creeped out?
Well, to be honest, you know, I thought it was unique. I definitely hadn't heard about anything like it before. But it is the biggest student organization in our schools. And I figured, you know, I might as well jump in, see what it's all about. And, you know, after being in the ministry for 2 years, it's really become something very important to me. And I think it's a mission that definitely could be spread to other schools. It's an awesome ministry.
What's the funeral experience like from your perspective, Sean?
When you're doing your first couple, it's a little bit awkward, definitely, because you don't know the people whom you're serving. So you want to try to be really respectful and just do your service. And, you know, you just hope that nothing goes wrong. Obviously, like you don't drop the casket or something. But mainly, you know, you just want to be really respectful and express your sorrow for the loss of those close to the deceased.
Jim Skirl, that's Sean McCann there, a 2014 graduate of St. Ignatius. From the mouths of babes, such wisdom, don't drop the casket. I love that. So Jim, how many have you done of these, and what are the surprises that you discover at these funerals?
You know, John, each funeral is different, which is kind of an interesting reminder that each person we carry is an individual, but we've probably done about 1,450 funerals over the last 12 years. And each funeral has its own story. We had one family where there were three remaining siblings, all of whom lived together in their elderly years. And when one passed away, they were all single people, and they had nobody else to walk with them. So the sister, who was in charge of the funeral, called us and asked if we'd carry her brother to his final resting place. 6 months later, her other brother passed away, and she called us again. And finally, we received a call a few weeks after that from a funeral director who had said that in her final wishes that she asked that the student pallbearers who carried her two brothers to their final resting places would do the same thing for her. So in a way, our boys were invited to be part of that family and part of their tradition and walk with them, you know, to their final places.
And do people show up who are connected to the deceased, who are surprised to see young people here or people from your volunteer corps?
Each funeral is different, but we received a lot of notes from families afterwards who say that their faith in young people is restored. They don't have a lot of contact, oftentimes, the elderly with young people. And when they see our young men dressed in their sport coats and ties and with their hair groomed and their shoes shined, a visible sign of presence, many people have said that this restored kind of their faith in the future generation.
Who have you met or who have you become curious about in the course of your being a volunteer, Sean?
I remember I served the funeral for a woman who was from the South. I think her name was Jimmy Ruth Bellinger. She didn't have any family remaining, but I think she worked at a railroad company maybe. And 7 or 8 of her friends from the company all came by, and they just really, they seemed so mournful, and it just seemed like there was a really close relationship between Mrs. Bellinger and her friends. And, you know, that was really cool to see that even though she didn't have any family remaining, these friends of hers were so, you know, moved by her passing. And then there was actually, about a year ago, I believe, there was a funeral for a Chinese man that we served, and he lived in a community on the near west side of Cleveland where really they spoke Chinese. They spoke very little English. So they were very tightly knit community. So it was just very cool for us to, you know, transcend language and cultural barriers and serve those people in their time of mourning.
That's Sean McCann, a 2014 graduate of St. Ignatius High School, a volunteer in the St. Joseph Pallbearers program. Jim Skirl, I'm blown away. I mean, did you think of this? I mean, this is just like the most fantastic. I can't believe this hasn't been done before, if indeed it hasn't been done before.
Yeah, John, we were a number of years ago, we were looking for ways to organize all of our Christian service initiatives under one kind of umbrella, and it just seemed most natural to seek to practice the works of mercy. And so we could go through those works of mercy. I won't quiz you, John, to remember your own catechism.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm a Unitarian. I'd fail all the tests. Come on.
Yeah, that's okay. But you know, to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to comfort the sick, to visit the imprisoned. But the last of the in the seven list is bury the dead. And when we were talking about our various service ministries, they said, how could we, you know, come help bury the dead? And I thought, we have young men who are strong and have time, and it would put them in a hands-on connection to live their faith. So that's really kind of the origin of this pallbearer ministry. And so just really to practice the works of mercy, which, as you know, have been really the kind of the social program of the church for 2,000 years. Mm.
And possible consequence being an unusual, or at least relatively speaking, unusual answer to the question, what did I do on my summer vacation, right, Jim?
Because they go, yeah, our students serve all year around. So our students will be serving a funeral tomorrow and one on Saturday. They serve over Christmas and Easter breaks. And so our students really realize that faith is supposed to be lived, you know, 24/7.
Jim Skirl is a theology teacher and the founder of the St. Joseph of Arimathea Pallbearers Ministry at St. Ignatius. And Sean McCann is a 2014 graduate of St. Ignatius who is involved in the Pallbearers Ministry as a high school student. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks, John. God bless.
Thanks for having us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
And now some basic questions that seem to have no answers.
How old are you?
How old am I?
Yeah.
I'm 90 years old.
What was life like when you were a little girl?
God, I've forgotten so much. I've forgotten so much. I'm very sorry.
For someone who has lived nearly a century but is afflicted with advanced dementia, her life seems to be gone. Or is it?
I want to try an experiment.
What?
I want you to try and let the music take you back into your memories. To travel back into time. And then we'll stop and you can tell me where it took you. You ready?
It is not as though she never lived. Everything she did, of course, she actually did. But how to access that? Could her favorite songs constitute some kind of ledger book for her experiences, where memories can be accounted for? This is what Dan Cohen, the executive director of Music and Memory, believes he can find, has found, in Alzheimer's patients through music. It is the story told in the new documentary, Alive Inside. Michael Rosato Bennett is the filmmaker behind the documentary. Dan Cohen told us this is a marriage of simple technology and common sense that delivers major insights into the functioning of the brain.
Most people spend their day sitting around doing nothing. Half the people never get a visitor in a nursing home on average. And so in 2006, I'd hear on the radio a journalist talking about how iPods are everywhere. And I thought, well, the kids all have them. A lot of us adults do. But, gee, in a nursing home, and if I'm ever in a nursing home, will I have access to my favorite 60s music? And so I Googled iPods and nursing homes. And even though there's 16,000 nursing homes in the U.S., I couldn't find one that was providing these for people. And so I called up, I live on Long Island. I called up a nursing home near me, and I said, I know music's already your number one activity. You have live music. You have a lot of people sort of providing group music, but can we see if there is any added value if we were to totally personalize the music? And they said, sure. I came in with my laptop and some iPods, and it was just, you know, an instant hit.
But hit doesn't really get to what you kind of do here in this movie, where you really open a door.
I would actually argue that the word hit is a perfect description of what happens, because, you know, that's what happened to me. I was just filming Dan for one day. I followed him almost unwittingly. It was just sort of a job, you know. So I ended up in this nursing home and looking around and seeing on every side of me these poor souls, like in these wheelchairs, lined up against the walls with their heads against their chest. And it just was the most terrifying image for me of how to end your life, or literally, it literally seemed like one of the levels of Dante's Inferno, you know?
Hi, Papa.
Huh?
How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm fine.
Who am I?
Huh?
Who am I? I'm your daughter.
Daughter?
Mm-hmm. Which one?
Wait a minute.
And then when Henry was brought in, and when Dan, you know, gave Henry the music.
You want your music now? Let's try your music, okay? And then you tell me if it's too loud or not, okay?
And when he started hearing it, and when it started sort of percolating in his soul, literally, and percolating this human being out of him, you know. Me sitting there 2 feet away, I got hit, you know. There's a physical, like, spiritual, electrical experience that happens when you see a human being who wakes up, who comes to life.
And the music, you know, opens this door and takes you down through this corridor of an entire life, and suddenly these memories come out. And what's it like to experience that?
Well, it's of course it's a joy to experience that. You know, we hear these numbers of there are 5.5 million people with Alzheimer's disease in the U.S. 40% of those have very advanced are in the advanced stages of that disease, and we as a society basically believe that these folks are no longer able to experience pleasure. So we give up on them. We give them these drugs that dull them even further, and nobody pays attention to them. But if we can, you know, because if you ask them, oh, here, you know, hi, Dad, I'm here, that's not going to do it. But if you put, you know, headphones on with music that has personal meaning to them, then they'll start to talk and reminisce and interact and maybe remember the name of their spouse or their grandchild that's there with them.
Did you expect visually this would be so vivid? You know, because this does sound, you know, without seeing the movie, like a kind of a nice charitable gesture, gives some people iPads, but visually this is just astounding.
There is something that I completely did not expect, you know, and I think it's really why people are reacting to this film as much as they are emotionally. And what it is these people, they've lost so much in their mind, you know. They've lost their memory, I like to say they've lost the capacity to lie. You know, but their capacity to love is still very profound. And so what I think happens is when you're watching these people, you're seeing something you don't often get the chance to see, you know, a completely unprotected human soul, you know, and then you're seeing that soul reacting to music. And it took me a year of filming before I could actually see the life in these people.
How did you do the forensics on individual people in the sense of how did you, you know, if they can't remember the tunes that really are personal to them, that relate to their specific memories, how did you find out what the favorites were, what the playlists were that were going to work with each of these individuals?
This is probably the hardest part. So if they have family, that's great. We'll ask some questions. Gee, what did they listen to when they were young? Did they play an instrument? Did they, were they in a chorus or a choir? And then once you have that list, you have it for the rest of their life.
Hmm. Anyone can relate to this experience in this movie. I mean, that's the thing. You don't have to. It's not about dementia so much as it's about, oh, I've got that playlist.
Can I ask you that question? Like, if I ask you to close your eyes just for 1 second and go back to when you were 15 or 16 years old and think of one song that was meaningful to you back then, like really think about it, feel it in your body, and then give me the memory that comes from that thought.
God,
come on.
There's so many. Since my dad played in a Dixieland band, there's a song called Lass's Trombone. And if I close my eyes and hear that Dixieland tune, I can see like my whole family and my dad right up there on stage. And
I just want to point out that the temperature in the room just changed when you started talking like that, because you went into a place of memory. You went into your emotional system. You went into a different part of your being. And this is the amazing thing about this interaction, and why, you know, we, Dan and I, have this dream that we can inspire young people to do this experiment. There's this huge population of elders that need that forensic work done.
Yeah. You know? I've got some Zeppelin videos, too, in my brain that I could go to, that's for sure. Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you so much. This has been really terrific.
Thank you so
much.
Excellent.
Michael Rosato Bennett is filmmaker of Alive Inside, and Dan Cohen is the executive director of Music and Memory, whose story of bringing music to Alzheimer's patients is followed in this movie. Alive Inside is currently open in limited release. Hit it. And if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, you can check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.